court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. I am just a dude.
Tommy, all the hype leading up to the Beauty and the Beast production that you and Mary have been working on, I have to say, after seeing the, your final brush up on last Thursday, or I guess that was maybe your dress rehearsal.
Yeah, final dress.
Final dress. Amazing show.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. It turned out beyond our expectations. You know, we aim so high, but you know, you never know how it's all going to turn out. But the actors that we have and the set and everything all came together, and it really is a magical performance. If we can just get the weather to cooperate, we got rained out Sunday, and we only do Friday, Saturday, and Sunday for 3 weekends. So the rain is costing us.
And even it rained that Thursday we were there too.
Yeah, that's true. The first 30 minutes or so.
I missed pretty much the first 30 minutes because I couldn't see around all the umbrellas.
Yeah, that's one of the hazards of it. And we had beautiful weather on Friday and Saturday.
Do you want to know the irony of whose umbrella was really blocking my view?
What's the irony of that?
It was Tony Cavalier.
The weatherman, the local news
sitting
weatherman.
Sitting in front of me with his big WSAZ umbrella.
We were cursing him. We told him he'd get into the studio. Maybe he could head this stuff off rather than let it be raining on us.
That's right. He can control the weather.
Ruining our costumes and microphones.
Well, I think my favorite part of it was the number where they have the cups and they clang them together and go back and forth.
Yeah, that's the Gaston number there in the tavern.
Man, that turned out amazing.
That's a really good number. That's one of those ones that really gets the crowd going.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, the choreography of them clinking the cups together back and forth, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's not one of the better-known songs from Beauty and the Beast, but it's a good one. It's kind of like Step in Time in Mary Poppins. That one always gets everybody up and moving.
Yeah. Well, since it's Pride Month and also the 50-year anniversary of one of my favorite cases from law school, I thought our podcast today should be about marriage in the United States.
Marriage in the United States.
Yeah.
Not as much of that as there used to be.
What, marriage?
Yeah.
Well, I think there's just as much marriage, but there's maybe more divorce these days.
Well, there you go. That's right. Per se, you know, you're right. There's the divorce rate is higher up. I think it's about 50-50 right now, isn't it?
I'm batting 100%.
Yeah. Zero out of, what, four or five?
Two. It was two.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I think... Yeah, the divorce rate's much higher. So,
and you keep adding to it, you're bringing up the average.
Well, I always was, baseball, tried to bring the average up as best I could.
So. Mary and I are working on the other side. We've been married 5 times, so, you know, we're bringing up the average on the other side.
But only to each other.
Right, only to each other. 5 times we've married each other.
Well, you've had some renewal of the vows and things like that splattered in there too.
Yeah. First time we eloped and the next time we got married in the church.
Yeah.
So, you know, they all add up though, I guess. I don't know. We're trying to do our part to keep the percentage up on the other side.
Well, everybody knows about the decision from the Supreme Court in 2015 that came out that basically said that any laws that the states had that define marriage between like a man, only a man and a woman and would not allow same-sex partners to be married, basically came out and said that was unconstitutional. But the basis for that case is one that back in 1967, it's quite some time ago. So that case's name is called...
I was a wee lad in those days.
Yeah, I was just a sprinkle in my parents' eye at that point.
I don't even think you were sprinkling yet.
Probably not. Maybe a twinkle.
I don't even think that.
Yeah, probably not. But
they were in the sandbox too.
Yeah. But the case name is Loving v. Virginia, which is a pretty kind of ironic name for a marriage case, I guess.
Aptly named case.
Yeah.
How could you keep two people named Loving from wanting to get married? That's just not right.
It's not right for a lot of reasons, which we're going to get into. So back then, there were these laws, and they were anti miscegenation laws. And basically, miscegenation means, and I'm probably butchering the pronunciation of that, but I think that's how you pronounce it, at least.
That's how we're pronouncing it.
Yeah, that's how I pronounce it. Basically, I don't need to
look
know,
it up.
I don't need to know how to pronounce it because I don't use that word in my daily parlance.
Well, why don't we just use the layman term for it?
What's that?
It was segregation, basically, what it came down to, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the actual definition of it means the interbreeding of people considered to be of different racial types. So, until this case came out, it was actually a crime to marry someone of another race.
That's correct.
So, and that the basis from that was back in the 20s, wasn't it?
1924, they had the Racial Integrity Act of 1924.
I'm just going to tell you on the face of the name of that, I don't like that law.
Well, yeah, you look at that. So, you know, something's going on there. But yeah. You look back through things in different periods of your life and you say, wow, can you believe that they did this back then? And I mean, you look at the changes. I mean, you know, even in the time that I've been around, some of the things, not that I witnessed them, but I was alive during the time that these things happened.
Yeah.
And now I wasn't alive in 1924.
Right.
But, you know, you're talking about some of the different things as far as integration and things like that. I was around then. And, yeah. You know, it's just hard to believe. People now, when you look at the generations now, like your Generation X or your millennials or whatever, this is a totally foreign concept to them. It's like a world without cell phones or a world without computers.
Yeah.
That you had a world where up until 1967, interracial marriage was against the law.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, that was only 8 years before I was born. So, I mean, it's not that long ago that this took place.
No, it's not. That's what I mean. It's just hard to fathom that could be a thing. And, you know, at the time they did it, too, I mean, the 1924 law was controversial in and of itself.
Yeah.
It basically defined everybody in America at the time, not 100% everybody, but the majority of people, you were either white or colored. That was the way they defined it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the one drop of blood standard. So if you had, if you were 1/16th, you had an African-American ancestor, you know, 16 times deep, you were still considered colored. Native Americans were considered colored. They were classified as that because they weren't white. So you had to be either white or colored. So they fell into, and lots of Native Americans lost their heritage because their birth certificates were all gone back and changed to where they were changed to colored.
Really?
And so they lost rights when different tribes were given rights later on in things and stuff like that because they couldn't prove their lineage because it had been wiped out by this law. Man, that's how unjust it was.
That was horrible. Well, to get back to the more recent 1967 case, not way back in the 20s, this Loving v. Virginia case, it was brought by Mildred Loving, and she was a black woman, and Richard Loving was her husband, and he was a white man. So to give you a bit more background, they lived in Virginia. And at the age of 18, Mildred became pregnant with Richard's child. So in June of 1958, they traveled to Washington, D.C. to get married. And this was basically to avoid the Virginia law, which had that Racial Integrity Act of 1924, which made the marriage between black and whites a crime.
So, that was in Virginia.
Yep.
It was still a crime. It was not on the books in D.C.
No, not in D.C., just in Virginia. So after getting married in D.C., they came back to their home. So story goes, and based on an anonymous tip, the police raided their house and found them in bed together, and they showed them their marriage certificate, but were told their certificate was not valid in Virginia because it was against the law there. So
it's even worse than that sounds too.
Yeah.
They raided their house early in the morning.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to catch them in the act of making love to make things even worse. Cause there was laws on the books about that too.
Yep.
So, I mean, that's even worse that was their thinking. This is how deviant things were at the time as far as that law
went. Completely sordid. So they eventually pled guilty to the charge of cohabitating as man and wife against the peace and dignity of the Commonwealth, basically because they were living together but not married. And that was essentially what they pled guilty to. And they were sentenced to 1 year in prison, but that sentence was suspended and they were ordered not to return to Virginia for 25 years. So they moved to Washington, D.C. They basically said, just get out of the state. I mean, think about that.
Yeah, you got to get out because if you ever come back, we're going to arrest you for breaking the law.
Put you in prison for a year.
Yeah.
So in 1964, they wrote to the Attorney General, Robert Kennedy, and he referred them to go to the ACLU. And the ACLU filed motions in Virginia to have the criminal charges vacated. Basically, they said that those laws violated the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause. And so after a long time, because the court didn't want to rule on it, but eventually the court got around to it, and the local court wrote, and this is, I mean, horrible. It says, Almighty God created the races, white, black, yellow, Malay, I don't even know what that means, and red, and he placed them on separate continents. And but for the interference with this with his arrangement, there would be no cause for such marriages. The fact that he separated the races shows that he did not intend for the races to mix. I mean, that's what the judge said.
That sounds like, that makes me think of the game of Risk. All the different countries are there, they're different colors, and it's like all the colors go to those, you know, you, same color stay in the same color country, you're not allowed to go to any other one.
Yeah, I mean, it's just insane. So, I mean, based on that, you can, I guess you can guess how the court ruled, right?
Oh, yeah. The court ruled against them.
So it was appealed, and the Virginia Appeals Court upheld the decision, and the case eventually made its way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
You know, one of the things that I thought was ironic, too, is it said at the time, if an interracial couple was caught having sex and they weren't married, it was a misdemeanor. Mm-hmm. If an interracial couple was caught having sex and they were married, it was a felony.
That's...
about that is completely backwards. Well, I mean, first of all, it shouldn't be any kind of crime.
Right.
But, I mean, so you're going to penalize them even harsher for being married than if they're just fooling around.
Well, you're breaking two laws at that point, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. But it's just unbelievable that I mean, it boggles my mind that when, I mean, if we were talking about the 1920s only.
Yeah.
Okay, I can understand people, you know, you think of people in that time frame being more ignorant, I guess. Yeah. They're not aware of these things. You know, the same way that terminology has changed and how we address people and how we address ideas and things like that. I mean, even cartoons. There were cartoons that I watched when I was a kid that now if you played the same cartoon and showed to people, they were like, you can't show kids this.
Yeah.
They can't see this. This is completely racist or misogynistic or stereotypical or, you know, too violent, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, we definitely, I mean, we're doing a better job as a culture, I think. We're moving in the right direction. We've still got a lot of work to do, but we're moving in the right direction, I think. So basically, they had oral arguments on this case, and the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the convictions in a unanimous decision, and that was on June 12th, 1967. So, you know, 50 years ago, as of June 12th, is when this case came out.
Well, so, thank God somebody finally had some sanity.
Well, Chief Justice Earl Warren, he wrote the opinion for the court, and he said that, and this terminology comes back into play here because it's kind of important. It says, marriage is one of the basic civil rights of man, fundamental to our very existence and survival. To deny fundamental freedom on so unsupportable a basis as the racial classifications embodied in these statutes, classifications so directly subversive to the principles of equality at the heart of the 14th Amendment, is surely to deprive all the state's citizens of liberty without due process of law. The 14th Amendment requires that the freedom of choice to marry not be restricted by invidious racial discrimination. Under our Constitution, the freedom to marry or not to marry a person of another race resides with the individual and cannot be infringed on by the state. That was a part of the opinion, how he held that.
You know what I'll bet Richard was saying to Mildred on their wedding day?
What's that?
If loving you is wrong, I don't want to be right.
Maybe so.
Because his name was Loving, see?
That's true.
So he was, he was making her loving.
I didn't know how many jokes were going to come from this episode, but you managed to squeeze one pun in there. Speaking of puns.
See, and loving her was wrong at the time.
Speaking of puns, did you see the post in a court-appointed Facebook page about the trees and all the...
Yes. Yeah, there were several chimed in on that.
They just kept going on and on and on.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a pretty good thing that guy did, though.
Oh, yeah.
In retaliation about his tree.
Yeah.
And somebody was right. I think that was a spite tree. We said a fence. A spite fence doesn't necessarily have to be a fence.
Yeah, it'd be so a spite tree.
He had spite trees, 100 of them.
Yeah, somebody cut down his tree in his yard. So in retaliation, he basically planted trees all over the city. to make them.
And big trees, too. Yeah. Sequoias and redwoods and stuff like that.
And I was thinking about, too, they're probably protected. They probably can't cut them down without permits from.
You wouldn't think so.
Yeah.
Where would you even get seeds or whatever for those kind of things?
Oh, there's places.
Oh, they're on the black market. Oh, there's places. I know a guy. I know a guy that knows a guy.
You need some redwood seeds? I can get you some.
I get you
seeds.
Some quality ones.
Those are the dankest redwood seeds you've ever seen.
Acapulco gold.
So essentially, the court concluded that these laws were racist and had been enacted to perpetuate white supremacy.
Duh, you think?
Yeah. Right.
Golly, that was pretty smart of the court to figure that one out.
They said that there is patently no legitimate overriding purpose independent of racial discrimination which justifies the classification. The fact that Virginia prohibits only interracial marriages involving white persons demonstrates that the racial classifications must stand on their own justification as measures designed to maintain white supremacy.
You know, and there's even more to that because Mildred was of also Native American descent as
well.
Yeah,
she was, yeah.
And when they were first arrested, she claimed to be a Native American, thinking that would lessen it. Well, they called in an anthropologist. Mm-hmm. And the anthropologist, by looking at her, made a determination that she was actually black. I mean, this is how ridiculous that case, yeah. That was before it got overturned. That was in the lower court, yeah, the one that ruled, you know, that everybody's supposed to be on their own island and everything.
Yeah.
So, and they had an anthropologist come in and say, well, by looking at her, she's clearly black. And that was the end of that. But, you know, it didn't really matter. But they took that a step further and they said, basically, it is illegal for her to marry anybody because of her mixed ethnicity, that anybody she married, they could have found that she was violating the law.
Yeah.
And you can't have laws that do that. How can you do that? You know, that's how ridiculous it was. They rejected that argument. But if you took into account what it said, it actually was true.
Now, the Loving v. Virginia case is very important because it talks about a fundamental right. And if you notice, that's what basic civil rights of man. It's fundamental to our very existence, is that what the opinion says. So it's a fundamental right. And because it's a fundamental right, when the U.S. Supreme Court looks at a law to determine whether or not it's constitutional or not, it has to pass what's called a strict scrutiny test. And this is one of the tests that's that anytime there's a law that infringes upon a fundamental right, it has to be applied this test to see whether or not it's constitutional. So the strict scrutiny test is, there's three different kinds of tests. The strict scrutiny test is the hardest to pass. Like a law, in order to pass the strict scrutiny, it has to pass this three different elements. And number one is it has to be a compelling government interest. Number two, it has to be narrowly tailored to achieve that goal or interest. And number three, it has to be the least restrictive means for achieving that interest. So, and this is like the most strict level of judicial review for these under the constitutional things. There's a rational basis test, which is much lower, and then there's intermediate scrutiny as well. So those are the three different kinds of judicial review for constitutionality.
Well, one of the other things I thought was interesting is they were saying, well, does it comply with anti-discrimination of the 14th Amendment? Mm-hmm. But the other thing is it also, does it comply with due process?
Yeah.
That gets thrown in there. And you don't think of, I mean, if I were thinking of what would have come into play on this case, due process would not have crossed my mind. But I guess what it's saying is you're being found guilty of something without really even having a say.
Yeah.
I mean, that's your due process, right? When you get to present your side and stuff like that, but you don't really, it's just saying you're guilty from the get-go.
Well, that's one of the things, but also it's due process is essentially when you're depriving somebody of a fundamental civil liberty as well. So basically that's violating due process as well. So if you take away somebody's fundamental liberty, that's depriving them of due process as well. So it's not, due process has kind of different textures of meaning, but that's one of the things. So basically when you say take away somebody's fundamental right, then it's basically depriving them of due process. So now the reason that this test is important is because it comes into play in 2015, the Obergefell case, which is the case that basically struck down all the laws that define marriage as only between a man and a woman.
Before we get into that, would it please the court if we approach the bench for a motion?
Well, I mean, yeah, go ahead. Approach the bench.
We'd like to approach the bench to pay court costs.
I almost forgot. We had that on the docket today.
Well, that's what I'm here for, to keep you from forgetting, counselor.
So who's on the docket today?
Today on the docket is ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates?
I do.
You do? Where's that?
ZipRecruiter.
You're right.
With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100 plus job sites with just one click.
One click.
That's right. One click.
Their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else.
That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours.
No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard.
Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results.
And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free.
Free?
That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/appoint.
That's ZipRecruiter.com/appoint.
One more time. Try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/appoint. It's the easy and most efficient way to find the candidate or to find the job of your dreams.
Getting back to the most recent case, the Oberfell v. Hodges case. So just to give you some little bit of background about Oberfell, it was actually a consolidation of six lower court cases. So if that tells you anything, that tells you that this was an issue that was ripe for ruling on by the Supreme Court. It was causing a lot of problems. Originally, representing 16 same-sex couples, seven of their children, a widower, an adoption agency, and a funeral director. And these cases came from Michigan, Ohio, Kentucky, and Tennessee. And basically all six federal district court rulings found that same-sex couples and other claimants were able to marry. So they struck down these laws. But still, it wanted to go up to the Supreme Court because of this issue. Now, each of the cases are, I think, on their facts are pretty compelling. I don't want to diminish from one case from the other since there were six different ones. But since Oberfell gets the top billing, that's I'm going to talk about the facts of their case.
All right. We'll go right ahead then. You're the one that knows your way around a transcript.
Yes, I do.
That wasn't an interrogation. I was acknowledging you.
So the Oberfell case involved a male couple, a widower, and a funeral director. In June of...
That sounds like a start of a joke.
I know, right?
Yeah. So two guys...
two guys and a funeral director walk into a bar. A courtroom. In June 2013, following the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in the U.S. v. Windsor, Jim Oberfell and John Arthur decided to get married to obtain legal recognition of the relationship. And they got married in Maryland on July 11th, because in Maryland they were able to do that. After learning that their state of residence, Ohio, would not recognize their marriage, they filed a lawsuit. And the name of the lawsuit was actually Oberfell v. Kasich, which John Kasich was the governor of Ohio at that time. They filed that in the United States District Court for the Southern District of Ohio, and on July 19, 2013, alleging that the state discriminates against same-sex couples who have married lawfully out of state. And as I said, the lead defendant was the Ohio governor.
This sounds exactly like the Loving case.
It does.
I mean, the same thing. They went to D.C. and got married, and Virginia didn't recognize it. And in this one, they went to Maryland, got married, came back, and Ohio wouldn't recognize it.
Absolutely. The reason they wanted to go ahead and get married is because the one of the partners, John Arthur, he was terminally ill, and he was suffering from ALS, which is horrible, horrible disease. And they wanted the Ohio registrar to identify his partner as his surviving spouse on his death certificate based on the marriage in Maryland. You know, that's for a whole host of reasons. Transfer of property. I mean, there's so many issues pop up for this.
Well, sure. Even kids.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have kids and you're not in a recognized marriage and you weren't the biological parent, then somebody else could come in and take the kids and from you. So
for inheritance purposes. I mean, just
sure.
So many things pop up from this. The local Ohio registrar actually agreed that discriminating against same-sex married couple was unconstitutional. So the local official there agreed with him, which is kind of different than you see in the news about that one Kentucky official.
Yeah, that clerk in Kentucky, yeah.
But basically, the state attorney general's office said they were going to defend the same-sex marriage ban. The case made its way up to the Supreme Court, and on April 28, 2015, they had oral arguments regarding constitutionality of these same-sex marriage bans. The opinion actually came out on June 26, 2015. That's today.
Well, that's true. No, that's not today.
Well, it's today when we release
a podcast. It's today when we release a podcast. It's today in the future, us.
That's right. Hey, future Tommy.
Yeah. Hi, future Mike.
So this is the anniversary of that opinion. So now this was a close decision. This was a 5-4 decision, and basically it required all the states to grant same-sex marriages and give full faith and credit and recognize the marriages of other states.
They got one justice in the bottom of the ninth to win it.
That's right.
It was all tied 4-4. So, they had to squeeze play, suicide squeeze on. That's got right. One justice in.
Just barely squeezed by. But now the breakdown of the Supreme Court, if you want to know what it was, because I think it's kind of important. Justices Kennedy, Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan were what I think to be considered the right side of history. And Justices Roberts, Scalia, Thomas, and Alito were the ones who were the dissent. The thing is that when that case was decided, essentially what they did was they looked at that Loving case and they applied that same kind of fundamental right, strict scrutiny application to that case. The Loving case was actually mentioned about, I think, near a dozen times in that opinion. So, I mean, that's basically what they relied on. So, I mean, this is one of those things, too. Whenever I was first started thinking about same-sex marriage and whether or not it was constitutional to ban it or whatnot, I immediately thought about law school and thought about the Loving case because it seemed very similar and the right sure. of people to marry. I mean, it's pretty clear, I think, in my opinion, as to what the right thing is based on our Constitution.
Well, I mean, discrimination is discrimination is discrimination. Just because, you know, whether it's an interracial thing or whether, you know, it's two men or two women.
Yeah.
Why is it not discrimination? Because they want to do that. Now, there's the joke that I always heard that Mary doesn't like me to tell. I heard a comedian say one time, let gay people go ahead and get married to each other. Let them be as miserable as the rest of us.
Yeah, that's right. I've heard that joke too.
So, she doesn't like me to tell that, so I'm not going to tell it.
Yeah. But I mean, if you think about it, it makes sense because really the right to marry somebody, we're not talking about a religious ceremony. We're not talking about things like that. We're talking about a government. I mean, I hate to use the word fiction, but it's essentially it is. It's something that's made up by the government, the ability to marry.
It's outdated thinking. I mean, the same way as in 1924 when they passed a law that said it was against the law for interracial marriages, it's just as the same thing now when you say, okay, why would it be against the law?
Yeah.
Why does the country have an interest in keeping people from doing that?
Yeah. What is the compelling interest? Go back to that strict scrutiny test. What's the compelling interest?
Right. Why do we want to? And not only that, would you not say that the societal norm is it pressures people towards getting married?
Yeah.
When you grow up, you hear that you are supposed to grow up, go to school, get a job, get married, and have kids. That's what you do. Okay, it doesn't say you have to marry somebody from the opposite sex. It just says get married.
Yeah.
And that's what they're doing. So if our society deemed we have a stronger society by people getting married, it shouldn't matter who they're getting married to. We should just be interested in them getting married.
Yeah, and when you get married, there are certain legal ramifications that come with that. You get tax benefits. Surviving spouses can get Social Security benefits, things like that.
You get shared health benefits.
You get access to medical records. You're able to make decisions on their behalf if they're unable to. I mean, it goes on. And it's just absolutely not about religion. And I mean, honestly, it is about love, but I don't even care if it's about love. It's actually a fundamental governmental right, in my opinion. Now, the opinion goes on, and I really like this one quote. I liked it so much, actually, that it was actually included in my wedding vows for the now defunct marriage. But I still like the language of it, or the verbiage. And this was actually in the opinion. No union is more profound than marriage, for it embodies the highest ideals of love, fidelity, devotion, sacrifice, and family. In forming a marital union, two people become something greater than once they were. As some of the petitioners in these cases demonstrate, marriage embodies a love that may endure even past death. It would misunderstand these men and women to say they disrespect the idea of marriage. Their plea is that they do respect it so deeply that they seek to find the fulfillment for themselves. Their hope is not to be condemned to live in loneliness, excluded from one of civilization's oldest institutions. They ask for equal dignity in the eyes of the law. The Constitution grants them that right. That's pretty poetic, I think.
That is pretty poetic. I thought it was interesting, though, Justice Thomas, in his dissent, said he took issue with the majority's view that marriage advances the dignity of same-sex couples. In his view, government is not capable of bestowing dignity. Rather, dignity is a natural right that is innate within every person, a right that cannot be taken away even through slavery and internment camps.
Yeah.
So, you know, they were, like you say, they were obviously split 5-4, and their opinions had to do one as how they saw the 14th Amendment, basically.
Well, I think what he was, his whole dissent had to go back talking about the Dred Scott case, and also I think it was the Korematsu case, which were the slavery case and the internment case, but they were decided basically on the whole strict scrutiny things as well. But the whole, I think the Dred Scott case is considered to be one of the worst decisions ever made by the Supreme Court. So I don't, anyway, I don't know. To me, it seems very clear what the constitutionality of it is, but you know, there are four Supreme Court justices who felt differently. So, but I think they got it right. There's no doubt, not a doubt in my mind that that's the decision that needed to be reached, because as a practicing lawyer, and I did some estate planning and some other stuff. I mean, I had same-sex couples come to my office all the time. And before this case came out, when their marriage wasn't, or their union wasn't recognized, or they weren't allowed to be married, then it caused so many problems, and it was really unnecessary. I mean, I had a client who, he had been together with his partner for, I think, 14 or 15 years. They owned a house together. And when the house was titled to them, it wasn't titled properly, so with a right of survivorship. Now, if they had been able to be married, it just would have happened by operation of law. But because they weren't married and the one partner died, I actually had to talk to the deceased partner's family to get them to transfer that house over to the other partner. Now, they ended up doing it because, I mean, they loved them and they were supportive of that. But imagine if a situation like that, where basically the deceased partner's family didn't like him, didn't approve of it, they would essentially have taken half that man's house just because of this whole reason that, you know, they weren't able to be married. It's just not right. I mean, it causes so many practical things that are just issues. It makes absolutely no sense to not allow people of the same sex be married.
Well, what it comes down to is, first of all, there's no way around it just being blatantly discriminatory.
No.
I mean, that's first thing. The other thing is it just morally, I mean, you know, there's things that are legal and there's things that are moral. Morally, it's completely wrong. Why would you keep people from that? You know, it's just like Lin-Manuel Miranda said at the Tonys a couple years ago. Love is love is love is love is love is love is love.
Yeah.
Why does it matter? You know, why do we want to intervene? Why does the government, why would they have a prevailing interest in what goes on? You know, it's going to go on in the bedroom anyway.
Yep.
Why would they want to make it be that you cannot marry and do that? You know, like say, when the societal norm is, we want people to marry.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they're almost their own arguments were against themselves.
Yeah.
Everything they argued just didn't work. I thought it was interesting that in the same-sex, well, you know, the same-sex marriage case, it had been going on for a while it finally culminated in 2015. The debate had been out there for a while.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in June of 2007, on the 40th anniversary of the Loving v. Virginia case, Mildred Loving, who Richard had died at that point, but Mildred Loving was asked to give a statement, and she said, "I believe all Americans, no matter their race, no matter their sex, no matter their sexual orientation, should have that same freedom to marry. I am still not a political person, but I am proud that Richards in my name is on a court case that can help reinforce the love, the commitment, the fairness, and the family that so many people, black or white, young or old, gay or straight, seek in life. I support the freedom to marry for all. That's what Loving and Loving are all about."
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, that case, I don't think it was super well known for the Obergefell case. I mean, I know people in law school knew about it and whatnot, but I think your average person probably had no idea about that case. They just knew that people who were black and white could get married. There was no, you know, growing up, I didn't know about that.
Do you think that to make up for that happening in Virginia, that's how Virginia Tourism came out with the slogan, Virginia's for Lovers?
I've actually done some research on that slogan. And yeah. I think it was just a slogan that somebody used and it just stuck. I couldn't find any real reason or basis for what it was for.
Well, it almost seems like they're trying to make up for, you know, that they had that other terrible law on the books and created all that hubbub by saying that. It's almost like an homage.
We are the best Virginia, West Virginia. So there's no doubt about that.
But. Yeah, that's right.
But that Loving...
We weren't a part of them in 1967.
No. That Loving case...
We just had our 154th birthday.
Yeah, we did. Yesterday was June 20th, West Virginia Day.
That's right.
I love West Virginia Day. Makes me feel always proud to be a mountaineer and free and stuff.
That's the day that Abraham Lincoln said, if you fight for the North, we'll give you your own state. And we said, sounds like a deal.
I know. I actually wanted to do the show on that topic since it was close to West Virginia Day, but I figured this was a bit more appropriate since our release date fell right on the Oberfell, and plus it's Pride Month, so.
Yeah, I mean, everything kind of came together there, and you know, it's something that's important and that people don't understand.
Yeah.
And in this area, especially where we're at in West Virginia, you had West Virginia did not recognize it at the time, and you had Kentucky around there, and you had Ohio.
Yeah.
So all those states, they still had the old laws on the books and didn't know how to address this issue, and even now, we still struggle with it in this state. While there's some cities that have put forth, I'm not sure what you call it, a proclamation or whatever.
Yeah, well, Huntington did.
Yeah, Huntington did, that has put forth proclamation that they added sexual orientation to the anti-discrimination laws as far as hiring and protections and everything.
Yeah, as it should be.
But the state has not done that.
Yeah.
And that's why when a case recently that originated out of here went to the state Supreme Court as a hate crime because a guy punched out two guys because he saw him kissing on a street corner.
Yeah.
And it went there and they took it as a federal hate crime and they had to drop it because there's no hate crime. It's West Virginia statute doesn't define sexual orientation.
Right. Well, I mean, the way the statute was written was poor. I mean, that's all I'll say about that. I mean, I'm conflicted about that decision because I kind of agree the way that it was written was poor, but I don't agree with the ultimate decision the way it came out.
No, I don't agree with the decision, but it's a flaw in our process. And here's the thing. Why don't our legislators address that?
Well, they need to change the law. They need to make it. They need to
But do you hear any of them say anything about that?
No.
About they're going to fix that and protect everybody that's here?
No, they're arguing about being able to drink raw milk and stuff.
Or a budget that they can't figure out what they're going to do.
Yeah. Now, the Loving case, it was actually portrayed in a movie that came out, I think, in 2015 or 2016. I didn't see it.
I didn't either. I didn't even hear about it.
Yeah, yeah. It came out. I remember seeing and thinking, oh, it's about time they're making a movie about that. Because it's a moving story. Now, I mean,
after doing this episode, I'd be interested in seeing it.
Yeah, absolutely. But it is kind of a sad case because Richard Loving actually died in 1975. He was only 41.
Yeah, he only made it 8 years past the decision.
I know. It's really sad. I mean, they did have three children, so that's kind of a good side of it. But, you know, it's kind of sad. You think about it, they fought so hard to be able to be married, and they only had, what, eight years to get it?
Well, I guess they had a few before that.
Yeah, a few more.
But still, but I thought it was interesting, too. They had done a movie earlier than that, like in 99 or something like that. And she made the comment, Mildred asked her about it. She said, the only thing true in that movie is that I had three kids. That was it. She said, none of the rest of it was true. It was made up. But then they came out with a biography about it. And then that movie in 2015 or what it was you were talking about, that one was based on the biography. And it apparently was closer to the truth.
Well, I think it was like a bigger budget Hollywood type movie, too. I mean, I remember, I think it was in theaters. I didn't get around to seeing it, so I wanted to. Maybe I'll have to check that out on iTunes or Netflix or something.
It's a very interesting case, and it's just, once again, you'd think, how come it just came down to them? How could we not have been outraged at the time? Because there was still a lot of states that had this law on the books. Virginia wasn't the only one.
Yeah.
And how come there wasn't more outrage that this was allowed? It boggles the mind to think about that.
Well, you got to think, I mean, for a case to get all the way to Supreme Court, it takes a little bit of luck. I mean, honestly, you have to have, because basically in order for a case to be heard by the Supreme Court, they have to have standing, which basically means they have to have been prosecuted under that crime. So, I mean, these laws may have been on the books, but there was nobody out there sadistic enough to want to go out there and try to break into somebody's house in the middle of the night to catch them in bed.
Well, so, I guess that's true.
And then, so that's the one, the first step is that. The second step is you have somebody who wants to stand up and fight for it. Then the third step is they find a lawyer who'll be able to do it. Then the fourth step is you actually get the Supreme Court to want to hear you. So, I mean, it takes a few things to happen. You know, you got to get all your ducks in a row, if that's the right idiom.
Because you're talking about a law from 1924 that was still there. That was an ignorant law to start with, but certainly times had changed and should not have still been there. And as a matter of fact, this law even went beyond just banning interracial marriage. This law, it doled out that it was okay for the government to decide who was, in their words, like imbeciles and feeble-minded, and it was okay to sterilize them, forced sterilize them, and over 60,000 people were sterilized under that program in the United States.
Man, that is scary.
And it was just like if somebody that was your guardian or somebody that had authority over you said, this person's feeble-minded, they sterilized you. Mostly it was women that they did it to.
That's less than 100 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that sounds like something you'd read that they did in Nazi Germany or something.
And at one time, the guy that was over, I don't know what you call the position, but it was like the director of health for the United States, whatever you could health. It wasn't health, education, and welfare at the time, but it was whatever it was. He was complaining in 1935 because the Nazis were beating us at doing the same thing. The Nazis were in the process of sterilizing their feeble-minded or people that didn't meet whatever their standard was. And he was complaining because his comment was, they're beating us at our own game.
Oh, man.
Because they were sterilizing more than we were. This is how far off our thinking was in how things were supposed to be.
You talk about being on the wrong side of history.
Yeah.
I mean, this is all dotted with it. I mean, I'd hate to be that judge's family who wrote that whole thing in the Virginia about the islands and the...
Ooh. Right. Well, and there's a very well-known chief justice that was quoted in the 1924 act that ruled on that he basically said three generations of imbeciles is enough. It must end somewhere when asked about that part of the law.
Well, I think that's going to bring us to
legal briefs.
So legal briefs is a part of the show where we go over different legal terms we discussed. And this one's going to be different. We're really going to focus on kind of one small area.
One small area.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And these are...
That's what she said.
These are the different Supreme Court standards for constitutionality.
Okay.
So I said there's three. Do you remember what those three are?
You have to have... The government has to have a compelling interest.
Oh, no, that's one of the prongs of the test, but there's three different tests. Do you remember the different tests?
Yeah, there's strict scrutiny.
Right.
Intermediate.
Yep.
And innuendo.
Rational basis. So rational basis is the least restrictive. Intermediate is the middle.
The middle. The middle is restrictive.
The middle is restrictive.
It's the Travis McElroy of the group.
And then you have, I'll never read con law the same way again. And then you have strict scrutiny, which is the Justin, the most strict. So, yeah, those are the three different levels. Now, strict scrutiny comes into play whenever...
I keep thinking you're going to say strict scrotum.
No.
Okay, good.
So strict scrotum comes into play...
Oh, you said it.
Whenever you have a law that impinges on a fundamental right. Now, that's where that three-prong test comes from.
All right.
So do you remember what that three-prong test is?
Well, the government has to have an overriding interest.
Yep.
It has to be narrowly tailored.
Yep.
And it has to address a specific problem or something like that.
Yep. The least restrictive means for achieving that interest.
Yeah.
So strict scrutiny, if it's a fundamental right, then strict scrutiny applies. It's got to be a compelling government interest, narrowly tailored to achieve the goal or interest, and the least restrictive means for achieving that interest.
So they don't want you covering a whole broad range. It's like, okay, so if you say that, if we determine that it's not legal to discriminate, whether it's against interracial marriage or same-sex marriage, then that's all that this is going to cover and make both of those legal, and that's the end of it.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, that's That's kind of, I mean, it has to be
I mean, it can't grant any other rights and conditions and things like that. It's got to be, that's what it means by narrowly tailored. What is the outcome you want? And it's got to be narrow. It can't be a broad range of things.
Right.
Because narrowly tailored, I just think that they're all wearing tight-fitting suits.
That is a tight-fitting suit.
It's narrowly tailored.
The other cases that have, you know, some other cases that have had strict scrutiny applied, just to give you an example of some of the laws, were the Roe v. Wade, the abortion case.
Okay.
The, as I said, the Loving v. Virginia, Brown versus Board of Education. So, I mean, these are the cases that are kind of the big hot topic items, I would say, that are, you know, your fundamental rights. And so when you say that it has to be narrowly tailored, you just can't be like a super broad law that addresses a whole swath of things. Like, I mean, maybe I'm being a little bit redundant in what you just said, but I'm trying to explain it better.
Anything's better than the way I say it, huh?
So, but yeah, I mean, that's your basic strict scrutiny test, and that applies.
Strict scrutiny. Try to say that five times real fast.
So now you're essentially a constitutional scholar.
Well, I feel like one.
Yeah.
I feel like I mean, if you brought me this case and I didn't know anything else and you said, here's the thing. We have an interracial couple that got married and the law forbids that and they're wanting to change that law. Now, what do you say? I'd say, do it. And then they say, all right, now we have a same-sex marriage and they're wanting to get married and their law says that they can't. They want to override that. What do you say? Do it.
Yeah.
So there. I mean, I'm as good as the Supreme Court justice. I might as well sign me up. Give me one of them robes. You know, do they wear the powdered wigs?
You got to write.
Do you get to wear one of the powdered wigs,
too? You got to write an eloquent opinion that's about 35 pages full of a lot of stuff.
I tell you what I would have written. I would have written, you all are a bunch of dumbasses if you think this is all right. I mean, what kind of world do we live in? Get real, people.
You need to be a television judge.
Television judge, like Simon Cowell or something, you mean?
No, I mean like...
Or on the Gong Show? They got the new Gong Show coming out.
Like Judge Wapner.
Judge Wapner, that'd be good. Be Judge Judy. Judge Judy, she hates guys. When they got a case up there and it's a guy and a girl, and the guy starts talking, she goes, shut up, I've already read it. I don't want to hear any more out of you. You speak one more word and she wins. She don't want to hear anything out of him. I can tell when you're lying, your lips move.
I wanted to be a television judge, but I already had my line picked out. I was going to try to be real folksy.
Mm-hmm.
And son, that dog just don't hunt. That was going to be my catchphrase. I'd always say that at least one time during the show.
Well, you'd have one other one you had to throw in there.
What's that?
You can tell who the guilty one is. Whenever you throw a rock into a pack of dogs, the one that yelps is probably the one that got hit.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well then, not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out though, right?
Usually.
Good.
This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurf. And I'm just a dude.